On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Big business is big news in America. The Dow over 12,000, former New York Stock Exchange chief Dick Grasso ordered to pay back maybe $100 million in superpay. For decades, one of the biggest of the big newsmakers in American finance and high-wire deals has been the legendary Wall Street titan Sandy Weill, the kid from Brooklyn who became king of the street with deal after giant deal. At the peak of 1990s deal-making, he built the Citigroup colossus. In the fierce bear market that followed, he was mauled for Citigroup's links to Enron and WorldCom. Now, Sandy Weill tells his own story. Joining me now from Saranac Lake, New York, is Sandy Weill. In 2003, he retired as CEO of Citigroup. He stepped down as chairman in April. His new memoir is The Real Deal, My Life in Business and Philanthropy. Sandy Weill, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. Great to have you here. Thanks so much. Take us back to the very beginning. What kind of kid ends up on this kind of trajectory to the very tip-top of Wall Street? Where did you come from, Sandy Weill, with that kind of hunger in your belly?
I guess that my first deal was really the best deal. And when I graduated college 51 years ago, I met my wife and we got married. And I think that a lot of what I've learned from her. And we've been partners all the way through, and it's been a terrific ride so far, and we're excited about what's to come.
So there's your most successful merger, you say, but there were an awful lot that followed that. You were a kid from Brooklyn. Did you grow up with parents saying, you know, be the next American business titan, Sandy, or was this, you know, where did it come from?
I think my parents, like a lot of parents in the 30s and 40s, wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer. They didn't really think that much about business titans, and nor did I. My parents never read the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. I think that my drive and my understanding was really something that happened over a long period of time. As I began to grow up and mature, I went into the securities business really by accident in looking for a job after college, and I ended up working at a brokerage company, Bear Stearns, mm-hmm. in 1955 in the back office, making $150 a month. So I learned the business really from the bottom, and this was before computers. And with the development of computers, I understood the importance of having an efficient back office, and being an efficient producer and the low-cost producer. And that was to help me a lot in the future.
At the other end of that process, you end up having bought and sold more companies than I can keep track of. Do you have a number? How many companies did you merge with, take over, buy? How many notches in the Sandy Weill belt?
I've never really counted all the notches. What I can tell you is that the only time I didn't change my name when I did a deal or a big deal was when I married my wife and I kept my name. Other than that, I always thought that the company that we were buying had more prestige, even though they might not have been doing well, than our company. And so our name changed all the way through the decade of the 70s as we ended up building a company that at the end of the 70s was called Shearson Loeb Rhodes. And we merged with American Express and we changed it to Shearson American Express. Then we bought Lehman Brothers and became Shearson Lehman Brothers. And eventually I bought that company back in 1993 and called it Smith Barney.
And on you go from there to Travelers, and ultimately Citicorp becomes Citigroup, as Sandy Weill sort of bites off or gobbles up the bigger and bigger name. I was fascinated by exactly that, the way these are nameplates that Americans know very well, brands that Americans know very well, but you would successfully move into kind of inhabit one after another. What was that about? Was the most important thing there the name? Was the most important thing the Sandy Weill mind inside the company once you got in there? How did you see the balance of those things?
I think really the most important thing in the deals that we did were the people that worked at these various companies and recognizing that whether a company was doing very good or poorly, all the people weren't responsible for the performance. And some of the people in companies that didn't do well were really outstanding people. And most of the acquisitions that we did allowed us to expand the footprint in the business that we're in, get more critical mass so that we could be a more efficient producer. And then eventually in the second half of the decade of the 90s, recognizing the importance of globalization and how the world after the collapse of the Berlin Wall was really taking on the capitalist system, creating equity markets and capital markets in different countries, creating the emergence of middle classes, and we had to go global. We were a great U.S. company as travelers, and that's when in 97 we bought Salomon Brothers, which was really our first foray internationally, and then recognized mm-hmm. that was not going to be enough with the Asian crisis and the problems that one had to have a really strong balance sheet and had to have the diversity of products and regions that you were doing. And we felt the best possible partner for our company would be Citicorp. So I called John Reed, and we set up a date to meet after a dinner at a meeting we were both going to. Mm-hmm. He came to my hotel room, and right. I spoke to him, and I asked him if he wanted a drink, and he didn't really want anything. So I told him, well, let me start at the bottom, start at the end and say, I think our company should merge. And he said, geez, I was here because I thought you were going to ask me to buy a table at a charity dinner.
Right.
And
that
I was willing to buy a $25,000 one. But this was like a $40 billion or $70 billion deal. And we ended up doing it and building, I think, the greatest financial services company in the world.
We'll have listeners who are deep in finance who understand exactly what the significance of that merger was, and others who just aren't in the business world at all and won't. It's the crown jewel in your long history of big mergers. What was it, apart from the scale, which was tremendous, but what was it about this merger of Travelers and Citicorp into Citigroup that made it such a thunderously huge deal in American business on Wall Street?
I think when you're in the financial business, it's really all about the people. The assets go up and down the elevator every night, so you want to have a business that is growing, that will continue to attract the best and brightest young people. But it's also a volatile business, and it's important that you have a very strong balance sheet, and that when you do things and problems happen in the world as these younger countries are evolving into more of a different kind of system than what they're used to, they're going to make mistakes. And those mistakes sometimes can be costly. So you want to set up your company so that when change happens or problems happen, you're in a position to take advantage of those problems and look at it as an opportunity rather than becoming a victim of those problems. And I think that the merger of Citicorp and Travelers put our company, our combined company, in just that position so that we were able to grow. And if you look in 1998, when the two companies got together, we were making about $7 billion a year after taxes profit. And now, 8 years later, the company is making three times that. So I think it talks about the success of putting this together through, as you say, the problems that took place at the end of the bull market with the problems with WorldCom, Enron, analysts, and investment banking, with the collapse of Russia, with the collapse of long-term capital, with 9/11 and that terrible event, and then the Iraqi war. And yet through all that, our company has continued to grow, and the world is growing. And who would have ever thought that countries 15 or 20 years ago that were communist countries would be the fastest growing capitalist countries in the world today, like China and Russia?
Made gigantic companies in America, Sandy Weill, behind many of those, made $1 billion, maybe plus, fortune for yourself. We'll look at Enron and WorldCom and what you make of that. I just wanted to ask you about, you made a lot of money along the way. You know Richard Grasso, who was head of the New York Stock Exchange. He famously made a lot of money, infamously in some quarters along the way. Today, this news that the courts are saying he may have to pay $100 million, as much as $100 million of that back. Your old co-CEO is in there as the head of the exchange. Now, what do you think of the Grasso ruling? Should he have to pay back the $100 million? Are CEOs paid too much? Was he?
Well, John Reed is not the head of the New York Stock Exchange now. He was
right.
At the point in time when this
court case
came up. I haven't read every article about this, but I did see this morning that Dick Grasso thinks that that decision is not an appropriate one, and he plans to appeal it. And I, as an American, have a lot of confidence in the American legal system that it will come out with a fair decision when everybody has had their time to argue their cases.
And how about the 12,000 Dow? We were there yesterday on that exchange.
It feels good.
Did you imagine it would ever go there?
Well, you know, 12,000, it was very close to being at 12,000 7 years ago. So really, over the last 7 years, it's been consolidating from really a Dow that moved from 800 in 1982 and that ended up, at 11,600 and something in January of 2000. And we've been consolidating those gains ever since. I think this country is a very strong country. I think that the outlook for the future is good. I think that goods and services are going to be produced in the countries that are the places that are the lowest cost provider of quality products, and I think that's good for the growth of the world.
Mm-hmm. Carl's calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Carl, you're on the line, on the air with Sandy Weill.
Hi, Sandy. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Carl.
I'm concerned about potential future dramas related, for example, to derivative securities. I recently retired from a competitor of Citibank, J.P. Morgan, and both companies have huge portfolios of derivatives. And what's Sandy's take on the risks to both the banks and the banking systems?
So we'll look at that. Mm-hmm. Sandy, do us a favor before you and Carl jump in. Define derivatives for us for our audience who may not be totally clued in there, and the concern around them, Sandy.
Well, derivatives are products that act like other securities, and basically the good part of derivatives is that it's expanded the markets, it's created real depth in a market so that there is a lot less volatility in some ways and more liquidity to enable things to happen. I think that one of the issues with derivatives is, and I think the caller is right, is that it has expanded balance sheets of financial companies. And I personally would like to see one common regulator that would be able to oversee what banks are doing in the derivative markets, because the counterparties are all other kinds of institutions, and that would combine that with banks, what securities companies are doing, what hedge funds are doing in derivatives, so that there is a common place where everybody knows everything that's happening. I think that would be a positive.
Carl, you've worked in the business. What's your concern about these derivative and the derivatives and the huge leverage that comes along with them?
Well, I think, Tom, you've put your finger on it. It's the huge leverage. And we saw several years ago in the case of long-term capital management the example of what can go wrong, that it took down one of the biggest hedge funds and threatened, actually. Sandy may know more about it because Citibank was involved, I think, in cleaning it up. But, threatened the world banking system simply because there was so much leverage. And since then, the proportions have gone up exponentially, and you read in the press that that problem has not been, how would I put it, completely solved. And I think that's why Sandy's talking about perhaps having one common regulator.
Right, not least in the hands of hedge funds. A lot of talk right now, Sandy Weill, about more transparency in the hedge funds. These kind of investment vehicles traditionally for the rich that take all kinds of big risks and when they're lucky bring huge returns, but without the public scrutiny that we've seen of other investment vehicles. Senator Charles Grassley, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee sent a letter to Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson saying, we've got to have more transparency here. Are you worried that hedge funds are getting us out too far on a limb, Sandy Weill?
Well, I think it's interesting what's happened over the last 8 years. We just were talking about long-term capital, and that was a $3.6 billion problem that they had with their investors.
A belly-up problem.
A potential belly-up problem that the private sector, the securities companies in the United States, the banks in the United States, and a lot of foreign banks got together on their own without any government help and injected $3.6 billion into long-term capital so that that company could have an orderly way of getting out and reducing their portfolio over a period of time, which ended up taking place over the next year and a half without any of the people that helped losing any money. But that was could have been a really big issue. Everybody was worried. But just look at today, a month ago, an institution called Amaranth, that was a
big hedge fund.
A big hedge fund, had a $6 billion problem, you know, nearly twice the problem of long-term capital, and that problem didn't even create a blip in the marketplace. The company is liquidating on its own. J.P. Morgan took over part of the portfolio, and the market was never worried at all. So the ability to handle things are growing.
So are you saying governments stay out? Everything's just fine in here under the covers?
No, I don't say that everything is just fine at all. I think that it really is important to have a real strong financial regulator that has the ability to get the insight from all of the players and know what's happening. And from my vantage point, and I've been on the board of the New York Federal Reserve Bank for the last 5 years. I think they are a phenomenal regulator with very, very competent people. And they've talked about how this can be expanded. And I think it would be a very good idea for Congress to consider how the Federal Reserve might look toward being the regulator that can look at the complications that are continually developing and continue to and new products that continue to come on stream so that there is one organization that has the intelligence to understand it and can put it all together.
Problems
on
potentially
a global basis.
Right, so big that they need the Fed to pay attention. Carl, thanks for your call. Let's take another from Sandeep in Boston. Hi, Sandeep. You're on the air with Sandy Weil.
Good morning, sir. How are you? My question is, what can you do to really provide an environment on the ground that does not suffocate creativity and the best and brightest really come out with their ideas, which they can execute within Citigroup?
Sandeep, I see right on my screen that you quit Citigroup 3 weeks ago in disgust, it says. Why? What's up?
Yeah, I admire Sandy Weil, I admire Citigroup, and I spent 8 years as a producer at Smith Barney, and I know that's very close to his heart. And I quit in disgust because those three rules, being loyal to our clients, being loyal to each other and the franchise, even though they're set at the top, there's no environment for that creativity to come out with your ideas. For instance, you have no closed-ended India-dedicated fund. And I'm sure he could raise easily a billion or two in that if he chose to.
Sandeep, let us take it. Sandy Weil, there you go. Straight out of Citigroup, and Sandeep wasn't happy with it at Smith Barney as he left and wants to know, funny to put it to you, but he wants it wide open and creative. That sounds like your style.
Well, I think something should be entrepreneurial, but I think, coming out of a problem at the end of a bull market, where there were excesses. Usually what happens after excesses is it goes to excess in the other direction to try and correct it. And then people will realize that they've gone too far in the correction, and it will come back to a neutral kind of position, which is where I think the industry and the financial industry is going today. I think that you see people talking about Sarbanes-Oxley, and has that gone too far in correcting the problems that existed before that, and how can the U.S. Continue to be competitive and attract offerings from all over the world rather than having some of those companies go and do something outside the United States, like the issue that was done today with the Chinese bank, which didn't register it here in the United States. And I think those things are going to happen. And I think it's too bad that Sandeep didn't stay, because I think that Citigroup thinks a lot of the opportunities in India. And I'm sure that they'll come up with products that will be able to take advantage of the opportunities that will be there. India is one of the really good good growth markets. And so I would say to Sandeep, he should think about going back because from what I think, it's a very good place to work.
Sandeep, there's the word from the top. Sandy Weill, you were a hero on all the magazine covers in the 90s with these big mergers and takeovers, Citigroup most of all. And then came, as you write in the book, The Real Deal, then came the bear market and sort of revenge of those who thought a lot had gone too far. And most of the country eventually signed on there, looking at Enron, looking at WorldCom. Citigroup paid billions to settle litigation related to the investment bank work for both of those. How do you end up looking back on that period now? Was Citigroup, were you so gung-ho that you were closing your eyes to real ethical lapses when it came to Enron and WorldCom?
I think it went beyond Citigroup in Enron and WorldCom. If you think about Enron, a few years before it collapsed, it was the most respected company in America in the Fortune magazine survey. WorldCom was growing all the time. I was on the board of AT&T through this issue, and every time WorldCom came out with quarterly earnings, we would look as to how many people we had to fire because we couldn't run our business as efficiently as they appeared to be running their business.
Appeared to be the operative phrase, but both of those turned out to be built on sand, and people looked at companies like yours as to say, you're supposed to give us the heads up when this isn't working. Instead, you had Jack Grubman, who, of course, was promoting WorldCom, Enron. You were writing there helping them do deals that got a lot of scrutiny later as sort of helping them with their cover story. So how do you look back on it now?
I think I look back on it, I wish it never happened. I wish it never happened for the investors where they ended up losing as much money as they did in those two companies. But I think it's important to remember that this was not just Citigroup's issue. Every major company in the financial business were underwriters of Enron and underwriters of WorldCom. And I think when the needle came to Citigroup, it was such a big target that we ended up paying more than most other people in some of the settlements, certainly not all of the settlements. But I just want to say that it was obvious to me as the CEO of Citigroup when this happened that we should not put our head in the sand. We should not say that we did everything right. It was very important to recognize that there were lapses that developed over this 20 years when everybody was making money. There were things that shouldn't have been happening. And what we try to do is, and we felt a responsibility to do, is lead the change to coming up with better corporate governance. And I think our company has done that. I think it's the most respected financial company around the world. And I think that seeing the market again go over 12,000, like you spoke before, shows that the public, you know, has confidence again in the U.S. marketplace, which is really the most important thing. We can't afford to lose the confidence of the American people. And what we did learn is that reputational risk, and we learned this in this period, is equally important or maybe even more important than market risk or credit risk.
So do it right. Sandy Weill's new memoir is The Real Deal. I want to bring another voice, if I may, for a minute here. Joining us from Bethel, Maine is Jeff Colvin, senior editor-at-large for Fortune magazine. He's watched Sandy Weill and his career for a long time. Jeff Colvin, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. My pleasure.
Here's a giant in the American business world.
Jeff.
Yeah, okay. No. He gives it to you, Jeff. The world gives it to Sandy. You know, he's got his memoirs out now. He is a legend. In your view, what does Sandy Weill stand for, ultimately, Jeff Colvin?
Well, for building the thing that he built there. I mean, it is an incredible story. As I'm sure you've said, Citigroup is the largest financial institution in the country, so large that it really has it required some of the rules to be changed, which needed to be changed anyway. But, I mean, you know, the end of the Glass-Steagall Act, for example, that separated commercial from investment banking, I mean, it was the rise of Citigroup that made that finally happen after years of people advocating it. But the ability to put these things together starting 20 years ago in 1986 when, you know, Sandy was actually out of a job and we wrote an article about it in Fortune. And
Experienced manager, good references.
That's
Sanford
exactly
Weill.
Right.
Yeah, God bless Fortune.
And you know, to put it together from, you know, commercial credit and then Travelers and then Citigroup is unprecedented.
What do you make? I mean, you've paid attention, a lot of attention at Fortune over the years. The Economist magazine looks at Sandy Weill's career, looks into his memoir and says, Mr. Weill's love of deals bordered on the addictive. And when you look at his own bio, I mean, it's just one after another after another. What drives that kind of acquisitive character, even in a business visionary like Sandy?
Well, that's really a very deep question because I think ultimately it's tough to say what ultimately drives it. But, you know, when you watch it in a number of people over the years, first of all, you know, deals are exciting. It's understandable how people sometimes do get or feel that it's almost addictive. But the danger most people run into is that they end up doing bad deals. They end up paying too high a price or buying things they shouldn't buy. And something you can say that's very strongly in Sandy Weill's favor is that he has done the vast majority of his deals on favorable terms. When you look at how Citigroup stock performed all through the 90s, it did really well. And for a company that's a big acquirer, that is a fairly unusual record.
Sandy Weill, how about it? Is that fair? Were you addicted to deals?
I think Jeff has been very fair, but just let me say about an addiction to deals. I don't think I'm addicted to anything. What I do think is that I've read a lot about what happens and is happening all the time in the financial industry, the magazines, the newspapers. So I had instincts about how things might change and where something would go. But in doing deals, if you ever did a deal where you weren't fair to the person you were doing the deal with, that person would talk and there wouldn't be another deal. If you did a deal where you were putting my company together with another company and we didn't do it well and we didn't pick the right people to grow that company into the future, I wouldn't have had a chance to do another deal. We've done a lot of deals over a period of time that took us, first in creating a critical mass so that we could be a low-cost producer, that it gave us the opportunity to invest in technology so that it helped that also, and that we did deals that strategically gave us an outreach into other countries, like the deal that we did with Banamex in Mexico, where Banamex really acquired Citigroup. They were making $800 million when we bought them at the 2001 or something like that. And today they're making over $2 billion after taxes. I mean, it's been phenomenal. And a lot of the managers in Mexico are going to run other operations of Citigroup because they are really good.
Jeff Colvin, I've just got you for another minute, a couple of seconds here. Is this the Sandy Weill model for a new generation of deal makers on Wall Street, maybe around the world? Is this the model?
It's a good model as long as you can be disciplined about it.
Jeff Colvin, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Holly's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Holly. You're on the air.
Greetings from Music City, a city that more and more businesses are moving to all the time.
All right.
I have two quick questions, kind of microeconomic in nature.
Yeah.
What's your take on these communities that are raising the minimum wage, and do you think it should be raised across the nation? And what's your opinion of the Nobel Prize going to the gentleman who was organizing all those microloans in the Grameen Bank? And I'll take my answer off air.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Holly. Great questions. A billionaire's take on the minimum wage. How do you see it, Sandy Weill?
Well, you know, I think that most people in the United States are paid much more than the minimum wage now. The minimum wage hasn't been raised in a long time. But I think we have to balance what that minimum wage should be with some kinds of lower-level jobs that really should be filled and are good for people starting out. So I think there has to be some balance. And
does that mean raise it or don't raise it?
I think it's probably at a point where it could be raised somewhat from where it is today, and I think it probably will be and should be.
On the same point related, what do you think? There's a lot of talk about the gap that's grown between the wealthiest Americans and the least well-off, and for that matter, where the middle class sits in the middle of that spectrum. Is that an issue of concern to you? You're sitting on a billion now.
Well, my wife told me that shrouds don't have pockets, so...
so give it away. We know you've done a lot of that.
And we plan to continue to do that with things that we have passion for. But you really raise an important question, you know, the difference between the haves and the have-nots and in the United States. And I really believe that the major answer to that is in our educational system. And I think we have a high school educational system in the United States that was developed a little over 100 years ago, and it's performing the function that it should have performed 100 years ago, which was to graduate about half the students, and the rest of them can go back and work on the family farms and work for their families and also work in unskilled labor. Well, the family farms have consolidated and become mechanized, and the unskilled jobs have left our shores, and now we need to have a new system where over, you know, 90% of our kids graduate college, and where we teach these young people that their financial future is really based on education. I started a program called the National Academy Foundation 26 years ago.
For urban kids.
For urban kids in inner cities, which started in one school in Brooklyn with a course in finance. It's now expanded to three courses. We have courses in travel and tourism and also in information technology. And next year we're going to start one in engineering, which really has very little diversity and very few women in that field, and I think it'd be a natural for us. In our program, we're now in 525 schools in 41 states with 50,000 kids. Mm-hmm. Last year, over 90% of them graduated high school. Over 80% of them went on to further education. We have over 2,000 companies that help this program. The Gates Foundation has just become a partner with us, which I'm really thrilled about because they're going to make a difference in education and they're going to make a big difference in healthcare, and it's a wonderful example to all people. So I think the way we handle that imbalance is show people that they can have a financial future here. It is very important.
Let me ask you about the other half of Holly's question. She points to the Nobel Prize that just went to the Grameen Bank and Hameen Yunus, based in Bangladesh. You have done multi-billion dollar loans. His group does loans of, you know, $50 or $100 to typically village women to start up some micro business. Does that even register on your screen?
Oh, absolutely, or a dollar or two. And I had the advantage of meeting this gentleman years ago. And as a matter of fact, at home I have a copy of his book that he signed to me. And Citigroup has been a big supporter of the Grameen Bank. We've worked in other countries, you know, Mexico and lots of other countries in micro lending. And it's not just $50 or $100. It can start with $1 or $2. And they pay that back and then go to $4. And it teaches people how to be entrepreneurs. It's a phenomenal program. And I think God bless that the Nobel Prize recognized something like this.
Sandy, well, you've got a caller from Augusta, Georgia, who's looking for some advice. Vincent, you're on the air, my friend.
On his golf swing?
No, I don't think so. Vincent, are you there?
Yeah. Hi.
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 Actually, I'm 12.
Good.
And me and my dad were looking. I was going to buy some stock, and I was wondering where to start.
Sandy Wild, there you go, from the knee of the master.
I think, you know, as a 12-year-old, I would look toward growth stocks because you have a lot of time to let these things mature, and I would look for a good mutual fund to start out with that specializes in growth stocks and another mutual fund that specializes in countries around the world, an international fund, because a lot of growth is going to happen not just in the United States but in a global marketplace. And I think it's fantastic that you're thinking that way. And I go down to Augusta every now and then, so maybe sometime we can get together.
Vincent, are you looking at a career in business as a 12-year-old?
Not yet, but...
and your investment with your dad, what's it aimed at? Are you thinking about college? Are you thinking about what do you want your investment to add up to and for?
I just think about it.
Well, there's some good advice. Growth stocks, says Sandy. Well, thanks for your call, Vincent. Let's get one from Milton, Massachusetts. Paul is on the line. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Mr. Weil, my question or perhaps comment is this. You maintain that globalization helps create middle classes in other countries, do you not?
I do.
Okay, let me put this to you then, sir. Globalization, like all human systems, is a tool. It you know, sometimes tools are adaptable, but usually tools are designed for specific purposes. For instance, you don't use a hammer to cook an egg. I believe the globalization, the directive that the tool aims for are twofold. One, to find markets, to secure markets for companies to be able to sell goods or services at the best possible profit. And that the other directive is to secure pools of cheap labor.
So, Paul, you're saying it's not making the middle class, it's all for Sandy Weill's Citigroup and its brethren?
Well, I think the thing is sure, if you go into these countries that the economic threshold is so low to begin with, that a bit of economic activity will look like an improvement. But I believe that will be temporary because I don't think that, I think what globalization will create is maybe to create a temporary middle class, but those people will migrate out of that middle class. A few will become like Sandy Weill, and the rest will become people like what's been happening in the United States for the past 30 years.
Paul, let us pick it up right there, if we may. Sandy, what do you think? That, you know, there's a lot of skepticism out in the world. Even at the same time, there's a lot of enthusiasm around this project. Do you hear Paul's full-blown skepticism there?
I do hear Paul's, and, you know, I think it's, if I might say, a little misguided. Just think about what would this world be like if we do not, if we completely neglect the people in these countries, because the labor is cheaper than it is in the United States or some other developed part of the world.
You mean if the companies don't reach out and use that cheap labor? You're saying it's a gift to them?
It's not the cheap labor. It's giving people a chance to improve themselves. And having some labor is better than no labor. It goes a lot to what Grameen Bank is doing in lending people money to start things that, you know, and to build something and to become part of society. The alternative is that these people will listen to somebody that will get them to go walk up a mountain, brainwash them, come down, and blow themselves up along with a lot of the rest of us. That is not a very good idea. We have to reach out and give all people everywhere a chance. You know, that's the way the United States grew. We grew by encouraging people to come to this country, that it's a free country, it's a land of opportunity, everybody can have a chance. I'm a first-generation American. Who the heck ever thought that I can have this kind of opportunity? And I think when you think about the world today with what's going on in countries like Turkey and China and India and Russia and Brazil and Mexico, and I can go on and on and on and on and on, that is creating a wonderful opportunity for people everywhere, including the United States. Look at the United States economy. It's the biggest economy in the world, and it's been growing at rates much faster than other places that don't recognize this. This is a good thing.
There's full support from Sandy Weill. Paul, we hear your counterview. Jeff is calling from Methuen, Massachusetts. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi, gentlemen. I just wanted to comment, I think you're politically wise to shine the light on the benefits of globalization, or diplomatically wise. However, I kind of sense what the previous caller was getting at was that more often these types of investments in the former third world, I don't know what we're calling them now, are come with a lot of arms and kind of negative impact as well.
What about Sandy Weill's story and the Citigroup story, Jeff? What do you see there?
Well, I wanted to actually comment on that. That you know, it seems to me that the desire for profit and it's not just desire for profit, but the drive for profit has caused Citibank and Citigroup to engage in practices where, you know, people who don't deserve a credit card can get a credit card and then end up paying percentages of like 30 and more for their to borrow money. And it just seems to me very clearly over the top, just way too predatory.
Jeff, let us pick it up. Sandy Weill, here's the face that a lot of Americans see, you know, through Citibank, let's say. It's the credit card offer in the mail, and Jeff looks at the big interest rate on the backside of that and says this is exploitation.
Well, you know, I don't think the rates are the level that Jeff is talking about, but, you know, people are have the right to turn down that offer if they don't think it's good for them. If we encourage people to understand about borrowing, to not borrow beyond their means. We try and do the best job that we can in determining who are the appropriate people that should be offered credit cards. We're not always right. When we're wrong, our company and our shareholders end up losing money, and we write off a lot of loans every year, billions and billions of dollars for mistakes that we do make. But people should have an opportunity if they think it makes sense for them to borrow something and to get something today that they might not be able to afford if they didn't borrow that money. It starts right at the very beginning. And there are plenty of laws in the United States that give people an opportunity, if they do make a mistake, to go and file for bankruptcy and start again with a relatively clean slate.
Of course, that's gotten a lot tougher in recent years with the legislation that no doubt Citigroup supported. When you look out on the
level
of...
I think, Tom, before that legislation passed, just about everybody that ever thought about going bankrupt went bankrupt.
When you look at the level of debt, consumer debt in general in this company, in this country now, Americans are carrying more than ever, savings rate down around zero or even negative. How do you look at that? You're a business titan at the top of the heap. Is that happening because Americans aren't exercising enough household budget discipline, or is it happening because of some other dynamic in the economy where they have no choice but to take on that debt?
Tom, I think the way our government measures savings is really inappropriate. I think the consumer today is in better financial shape and strong financial shape, better maybe than they've been in a long, long time.
In spite of the debt? In spite of all those stacks of credit cards?
If you take a look at what the consumer balance sheet is today, with the value of their houses, with the values of their 401k, with the value with the stock market more than coming back to the highest levels, they're debt now is only represents something like 17% of their annual inflow goes to paying down and servicing debt. So it's not a very big number. I remember when I got married, I was told that I can afford to spend 25% of what I make on renting an apartment. And here I'm saying all of the debt, including the debt for housing, I believe, is something like 17 or 18% of what an American's income is. So I think the American consumer is in terrific shape. They've been paying down their credit card debt over the last year. They've been borrowing more money on real estate at very, very low long-term rates. Most of the debt is fixed rate, not floating, so that the great majority will not go up. So I think we can look for the consumer doing well. And if oil prices continue to go down and we don't have blow-ups in this world, I think oil prices will go even further. That'll be even better for the consumer.
There's a view from the top. One more call. John in Rockport, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Yeah,
hi. Thanks for the call.
Yeah.
I really enjoy the show. Mr. Weil, I'm just curious. You know, this goes back a little bit. Just give you a brief history. My dad was a vice president of a big company in Boston where the guy at the bottom was making, let's say, $8,000 pushing a broom, and the guy at the top was making $150,000 a year, and that's pretty accurate. So there was somewhere around a 20 times ratio or relationship between guy at the bottom, guy at the top. What do you think the appropriate relationship should be today?
I don't know. I think what we should be doing is improving the outlook and the opportunity for the person at the bottom. And I think that starts with their high school education, and it starts with mentoring them when they go to work in a company and helping them so that they know what they have to do to really get a very good job and to continue to grow.
But what about the top? I mean, the implication here is, you know, is there a point at which the top gets so well paid that it's just fundamentally out of whack, that maybe in a democracy the power of all that money at the top throws the system out of balance? Is there any limit? We hear you're concerned about the bottom, but what about the top?
That's a question for me, Tom?
Yes, please, Andy.
Okay. Yeah, I think basically if people at the top are paid too much, our system will eventually change that. And I think we have a very strong...
At what point? We're pretty far along that line right now, aren't we?
I think in some cases, yes, and in some cases, no. If a person really performs for their customers, for their employees, for their shareholders, that person is worth something that people think is appropriate and competitive with what people are paid in other countries and in other businesses. If somebody is getting paid a lot of money just to come to work and is not creating a family kind of environment in the company, is not creating a kind of environment to attract bright people, to create teamwork, which is really required to build something, then that person really should not only not be making what he's making, he should not have the job. And the CEO position, it appears these days, has become pretty vulnerable.
Sandy Weil, we just got 5 seconds here. Your wife writes at the end of the book she's worried about you once you're no longer a CEO or chairman, that you wouldn't be able to take it without that big job going on. How's it going?
Well, my wife is sitting next to me. She is my handler, and I think it's going great, and we look forward to really making a difference in what we do from here on out.
That's great. Sandy Weil, the memoir is The Real Deal, My Life in Business and Philanthropy. Thanks for joining us.
Please buy my book.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.